Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 29th, 2014, and this is show number 477. I said that with emphasis because I talk about the live show audience pretty much every week. One of their responsibilities is to point out when I say something dumb. I don't think they're taking the responsibilities very seriously lately, though, because not one of them noticed that last week I said it was show number 475. Now, you might have thought it was 475 because the week before I said it was 474, but in fact, two shows ago, that was a mistake. I'm a bit lost here now, but I'm pretty darn sure that it's number 477 this week. I wanted to call this to your attention, especially if you come to the live show, that I expect you to pay better attention in the future. Well, even if you're not a photography nut, I think you're going to be interested in a topic that has many of us in a tizzy this week, and that's the announcement by Apple that they are not doing any further development on their high-end photo application, Aperture. Aperture is currently a version 3-something, with a bunch of point releases after its initial release. Aperture 3 came out in February 2010, over 4 years ago. Sure, we got some good stuff like photo streams, which I love, and integration with SmugMug, but if you read the vast list of what's changed in the last 4 years, I've got a link to it in the show notes, it's pretty much more bug fixes than anything else. Many of us have been sitting on the edge of our seats waiting and hoping for something wonderful to come out of Cupertino any minute now to make those Adobe Lightroom users stop waving their massive enhancements in our faces. The best news to me is that Apple actually announced that they're not upgrading Aperture. So, at the very least, we can stop hoping and expecting it. 6 months ago, my friend Nancy asked me to recommend a photo management application to replace iPhoto, and I told her to wait because I was sure Aperture is going to be updated soon. Well, the next best news is exactly what they said in the announcement, word for word, as posted by Jim Dalrymple on The Loop at loopinsight.com. Here's the quote. With the introduction of the new Photos app and iCloud Photo Library, enabling you to safely store all of your photos in iCloud and access them from anywhere, there will be no new development of Aperture, said Apple in a statement provided to The Loop. When Photos for OS X ships next year, users will be able to migrate their existing Aperture libraries to Photos for OS X. So it looks like both iPhoto and Aperture are going to go away, and Photos will take their place. Now, you have several ways to think about this, depending on your optimistic versus pessimistic view of the world. You could look at it this way. Apple will do to Photos what they did to iMovie, Final Cut, and iWork, leave out major features on which professionals depend, and make a dumbed-down application that pleases the masses but not the serious users. Or Apple will make Photos amazing and to make it integrated to the best of the lower-end tools and the high-end editing tools for a photo experience that will blow our minds. The thing is, whether you go with optimism or pessimism, there's one thing we know for sure. There's no replacement for Aperture for another year. That means a total of 5 years without an update. Gotta tell you, that bums me out big time. However, I am still glad that they didn't leave us hanging, that they give us this much information, because that's a level of communication with us that's a very new thing from Apple. Now, I promised at the beginning of this that I would make it interesting for non-photographers. My premise is that in our geek lives, at some point in time, we will have to change away from our favorite application to a new one. I've always been a strong believer that if you're really good at one program, you shouldn't worry about it, and you should be able to get really good at the new one, too. I remember at work many years ago, there were these guys who were entrenched in one mechanical CAD program, and they said, "We'd rather be fired than switch." Sadly, they thought that made them more valuable to the company. It turns out they were wrong. Now, I'm trying to wrap my brain around that philosophy of mine that I've always held and apply it here. Gotta tell you, I'm starting to feel sympathy for the CAD guys, I'm afraid. When I think about switching applications, when I've always thought about that, I've always thought like my beloved Excel versus Google Docs. I've almost entirely switched. I may open Excel from time to time, but most of the time, yeah, Google Docs is fine. Or maybe go from Word to Bean or even text edit. I don't break a sweat about that at all. However, when it comes to Aperture, there's so much history at stake, it's really hard to imagine switching. I mentioned earlier that the competitor is Adobe's Lightroom, which has been advanced regularly by Adobe and, from what I hear, is a terrific product. It does much of what Aperture can do, has more capabilities in some ways than Aperture, some of which you can get with plugins on Aperture that you have to get from a third party, but Lightroom has some drawbacks as well. Let's think through some of the things that give me cold chills about changing to Lightroom. Here's a couple of examples. When you edit a photo in Aperture or iPhoto, the edits are non-destructive. You can crop like crazy, darken, lighten, change colors, get rid of red eye, anything you want. And you can always get back to the original photo. If you move your photo library to Lightroom, all of these changes are gone. Aperture and Lightroom Like It store these changes in metadata, and they're not interchangeable between the two programs. Now, you might have heard that Apple was going to be working with Adobe to help people move to Lightroom. TechCrunch missaid that. They posted it, and then they retracted it. So we do not believe that's true. So anyway, it's really, you can't move the metadata. Aperture was a one-time cost for version 2, and then there was an upgrade cost for version 3, and then partway through its most recent life cycle, Apple let everybody have the App Store version instead. This actually seems rational. Since they haven't put much work into enhancing it, you shouldn't have to pay much more for it. Lightroom used to be triple the cost of Aperture. At one time, Aperture was $100 and Lightroom was $300, which was another reason I did never go for it before. Now they've gone to a fee-based thing. Instead of you buying it, you actually rent your software. Now they advertise Lightroom as a monthly fee, but that's actually not true. It's an annual fee that's billed monthly. Some see it as a good value. It's $120 a year for Lightroom and Photoshop. I know people who like both that just, man, that is a fantastic deal. But I don't need Photoshop because I bought Photoshop Elements. I bought it for $100. Remember that? 3 weeks later, Adobe came out with an App Store version and told me to pound sand and that I couldn't have the App Store version. Thanks. All right, next up, Lightroom is from Adobe. I probably don't need to go any further than that. They've got security holes like nobody's business. They've got mean business practices. See what I just said about the App Store version. They used to charge Australians, it was like 2 or 3 times as much for the Creative Suite as they did the rest of the world, just because they could. They also provide some lovely bloatware. All right, the other thing in Aperture's favor is Aperture integrates with the Mac much more closely. Inside all of the Apple apps that have media libraries, you can see your Aperture library. From Aperture, I can go straight into Mail. I have access to Photo Streams, which I mentioned that I love, and I use that like crazy for sharing with my family. I can open my Aperture library inside iPhoto and make my yearly calendars and lovely photo books. For me, the answer is going to be to wait and see what happens with in Photos. Now, I don't know how long I'll be waiting, but I think I can stand it. Because I'm guessing that at a year, it's going to come out, but it's going to be kind of weak, and then it's going to build back up, kind of like what they did with iWork and Final Cut. Like I said, not knowing was harder than this. I got to tell you, I'll be first in line downloading Photos when it comes out, and I'm sure I'll find a lot to whine about, but I bet it'll be fun to play with something new. The big question will be whether they really care about photographers or just the everyday snap shooter. I'm encouraged by Joseph over at Aperture Expert, apertureexpert.com, because he was contacted directly by Apple on the subject. He sees the fact that they contacted him directly and others in the pro photographer world as a sign that Apple does care about us, not that I'm professional, but they are, and will make this product awesome. Here's hoping. If you're anything like me, you have a mess in your Apple contacts because of how badly it handles multiple people's phone numbers who live in the same household. If I know a couple, for example, that I want to send a holiday card to each year, I end up with 3 cards for them. I have one for the couple with their physical address, and then one for each of their individual cell phones. Sometimes I only know one of them well enough to use their cell phone, so I have a combined card and then one extra individual card, but back in the combined card, I still can't tell which number is which. This week, Steve figured out a way to solve my problem. I did a blog post and a clarified tutorial on it, of course, but I can walk you through the trick pretty easily. Let's say you have 2 friends, Bob and Sally Schwinkendorf. In their V card, you have 2 mobile numbers. Click on Edit in the bottom right, and then click on the word mobile next to one of those numbers, or it might say home accidentally because it seems to get wrong, or it might say iPhone. Anyway, click on that. You'll see a list of predefined choices like home, work, mobile, but at the bottom, it should show custom as an option. Choose that and put in anything you want to identify that number. You can change Bob's number to say Bob Cell or Spider-Man or whatever helps you remember that it's his number. Rinse and repeat for Sally, and you're all set. Now, I'm going to have to do a bunch of cleanup on my contacts over time, but it'll make me so happy to get this mess cleaned up. Now, one thing you might think that when you go in to do the next person's in that list of options, you're going to see Bob sell and Sally sell. You don't. You only see it in the if you scroll down into the list that's below that. There's actually a secondary list. You'll see it there, but you don't. It doesn't get in your way at all, which is really nice. I did some tests with our friend Diane to make sure that when she called me, it would still say her name, because now I've combined her and Bill together into one card. And when it came, it said Diane and Bill at the top, because that's how they're listed together. And then below it, it said Diane Sell, just like it was supposed to. So take a look at it. I did find it a little bit harder in messages to tell who was who, but I always have trouble telling what phone numbers, what messages anyway. So it doesn't work. Doesn't work that well anyway. All right. I want to thank Steve for an awesome tip. Well, I am still having a ball with my new mirrorless camera, the Olympus OMD EM10. When I first started looking into this, I mentioned that I was going to make the switch to my friend Diane, same Diane I was just talking about. For some odd reason, she trusts my judgment and said, "All right, great. When you decide, just let me know what to buy." Like me, she loved her big girl camera, but didn't enjoy lugging it around. I remember when she was going to France and she had to debate which lens to bring because she just couldn't bear the idea of carrying more than one. After I did the research and bought mine, we went out and bought one for her, too. She loved it at first sight and has gotten very adept with it very quickly. We both bought our cameras with a 14-42mm kit lens. I got to take a break here and explain crop factors because this whole story is not going to make any sense without it. It's a really, really interesting story. All right, the crop factor is the ratio of the sensor size in a camera relative to a reference format, which is the old 35mm film cameras. It sort of makes them all be able to speak the same language when you refer to the crop factor. You'll hear people talk about a digital camera with a full frame sensor. That means the imaging area on that camera is the same as the old 35mm film image area. Now, Diane and I both had Nikon DSLRs in the past, our big ones, which had a crop factor of 1.5. That means to figure out the 35mm equivalent on a lens, you take the lens magnification you're talking about and multiply times 1.5. So if we put a 40mm lens on our Nikon DSLRs, it's really 40 times 1.5 or 60mm equivalent. I know it's a lot of math, but stick with me. It's going to be worth it. I hope that makes sense. All right, now our new mirrorless cameras make the math easier because the Olympus EM10 has a crop factor of 2. When Diana and I were talking about lenses, she said, "I want a big zoom like the one I had on my Nikon, which zoomed up to 200 millimeters." I explained to her that the 200 millimeter lens on her Nikon with a 1.5 crop factor was actually equivalent to 300 millimeters. I then explained that she only needed to buy a 150 millimeter lens on the Olympus because of the 2x crop factor. 150 times 2 is 300 millimeters. So her old 200 millimeter and a new 150 millimeter lens would both be 300 millimeters. Any chance anybody's still with me on all this math? Well, Diane believed me and bought a 40 to 150 millimeter lens on my advice. In fact, we both bought the same lens. She understood the math, but said, "I just can't feel it." So she decided to do an experiment to prove it to herself. She took her Nikon D40 and put on her 18 to 200 millimeter lens and zoomed it all the way in. With the crop factor, again, that should be 300 millimeters of zoom. Then she took her Olympus EM10 and put on the 40 to 150 and zoomed it all the way in. With its 2x crop factor, it should also be 300 millimeters. So these two cameras should both be seeing 300 millimeters. The image should be the same. She set them side by side on a table with the bodies lined up and took a picture from each one of the same subject. Her results completely confused me. The mirrorless Olympus EM10 showed a more zoomed up image than the Nikon D40 DSLR. They weren't off by a lot, but there was definitely a significant difference. By the way, the images are in the show notes, so you can see what she found. I dashed off a note to Stephen Getz, who he's the guy that convinced me to go down this mirrorless path. Such an enabler. And by the way, that makes him forever obligated to answer every photography-related question I might have for the next 5 or so years. I asked him to explain how this could possibly be. To me, it's either I'm completely wrong about how this works, or Diane's a moron, and Diane is not a moron, therefore I must be wrong, so what's going on? Well, Steve came back with a fascinating answer that I knew nothing about this. Evidently, the lens that Diane was using, her 18 to 200 millimeter lens from Nikon, allows you to focus on objects extremely close to the lens, as close as 8 inches from the front of the lens. This is extraordinarily close for a big zoom lens. Stephen found out there's a trick, though. The 200 millimeter is only achieved when you focus at infinity. If you think about it, you normally need or want a big zoom when something's really, really far away, so getting the full 200 millimeter when focused at infinity is a perfect thing. Stephen went on to explain that when you focus on closer objects, the internal focusing mechanism of this particular lens deliberately shortens the focal length to achieve that focus. Even though your lens dial shows 200 millimeters of zoom, you're not really zoomed up to 200 millimeters. Isn't that crazy? Well, Stephen gave a link to kenrockwell.com if you want to read the full explanation of how this is accomplished. After learning all of this, I ran the same test with my Nikon D40 and a Sigma 18-200mm lens, comparing to the same 40-150mm lens from Olympus that Diane was using. I got the same results. When I focused on something at long distance, both cameras captured the same field of view. With something closer, however, the Olympus lens zoomed in more than the Sigma. I am losing something, though. The Olympus Micro Four Thirds lens can only focus up to 35 inches away, while my old Sigma could focus at 18 inches away, and hers was 8 inches away. So I've lost about half the distance, meaning I have to be twice as far away to actually get it to focus. Anyway, I thought this whole thing was fascinating, and I hope you did too. I'm not sure Diane is ever going to believe me again when I tell her this kind of stuff, though. I've been telling you guys about the free beta trial of Clarify 2 for a very long time, and the guys over at Blue Mango Learning swear to me that they're getting really close to finally releasing it. I thought it might be fun to get you excited about the new features that are coming in this awesome software designed to help you clarify things on your computer. First of all, you're going to be able to auto-number your steps. I think I remember the guy saying this was pretty much the number one requested feature. You're going to be able to create sub-steps. This is going to help you make it look more like an outline, especially if you turn on auto-numbering. So if you have a step 2 and then you make the step after that a sub-step, it'll be numbered 2.1. I have found a bunch of cases where it really helps to separate the concepts in a longer tutorial. You'll be able to add multiple images to a single step. I tested out multiple images this week when I did a tutorial on how to use the custom categories on contacts that Steve told us about. I wanted to illustrate the mess you get when you have three cards for a single couple, so I used the multiple image feature to put all three cards in one step. A small but cool new feature I found just the other day is that you can toggle the text location on a per-step basis. So the default is to have the text appear above the image, but sometimes it might make more sense to have it below. You can just toggle it up and down with a single command. Now, there's a lot more to Clarify too than this, but I'll leave you with that tease for now. If you would like to test it out, and remember, it is a beta, head on over to the link in the show notes at clarify-it.com. If you want to drive yourself there, go to blog and then look at the latest blog and you'll find download in there. Anyway, go ahead and give it a spin, and I promise you, it is going to come out soon. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And just to keep the audience completely guessing, we are doing Bart 2 weeks in a row. How are you doing today, Bart?
Hi-ho. The good news is this way we have like security light in a manageable portion.
There you go. And we're going to continue with the 40,000 foot look at programming. So yes. This should be better continuity than maybe we do other times. So I appreciate you coming on 2 weeks in a row. That helped me out.
Well, I had all the notes written last week, so it made life easy for me as well.
There you go. All right, let's kick into Security Light. What do we got?
Okay, so no important security updates at all, because it's only been a week. So we can jump straight into news. And the first is that PayPal's two-factor auth had a wee bit of a whoopsie in it, as in you could bypass it. But PayPal have put a mitigation in place. So no need to panic. You can keep using your PayPal football and all that kind of stuff. It is now no longer broken, but it was broken.
Okie dokie. That's kind of scary, but all right.
Yeah, and they implemented it spectacularly badly. The Naked Security article in the show notes explains what they did wrong quite well with an interesting analogy. And it was just backwards. They just designed it backwards. But now they have put mitigations in place, and apparently they're redoing it better by the end of July as well.
Do you do two-factor on that?
I would if in Ireland we could get the little football.
The little football.
A little doohickey that changes numbers every minute.
I have no idea what you're talking about. You're talking about the...
For PayPal, you can get one of those authenticator doohickeys in the US, like you would get if you worked at a Fortune 500 company.
Oh, okay.
The numbers change and that kind of thing. But the last time I checked, we couldn't get them here in this little country.
So the two-factor authentication doesn't work where it texts you a number and then you'd enter that?
Well, they may do it that way too, but I know that their proper two-factor authentication is with a little token.
Okay. Yeah, that would be a lot easier. Yeah. I've done the two-factor on one thing, and it's just like, oh, man, it's hard. All right, what's next?
Okay, so apparently a lot of people use a WordPress plugin called Tim Thumb, which is for creating thumbnails from photos. And unfortunately, it had a rather large bug in it, which it allowed remote code execution on your web server, which is spectacularly bad.
Thanks.
Yeah, so I don't usually do every little WordPress whoopsie, but in this case, I thought this one was bad enough to say, if anyone in our listeners has this plugin installed, update ASAP.
And the reason, for those who are new to the game, remote code execution basically means whoever does it to you is now you.
Right. So they can do on your server whatever they feel like, which means they can implant all sorts of lovely malware onto your website, and then you can then, on their behalf, attack all of your visitors, which is not good. Yeah. Then we get to end on two good news stories. So the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled that law enforcement need a warrant to search your smartphone, which to me is stating the obvious, right? Fourth Amendment. So the Fourth Amendment has survived into the 21st century, I think. We can all give three cheers.
Now, we still, going in and out of Canada, Canada can do it to us without a warrant.
And there's a whole of the, I'm not sure if this affects what the border guards get to do, because I know there's a lot of weirdness about when you're going around the border, they seem to get away with breaking your Fourth Amendment rights a lot more than they do elsewhere.
Yeah.
But if you're stopped in traffic, they can't just search your phone for the crack, which they used to say they could do. So, you know, I disagreed with other things the Supreme Court had to say this week. The Aereo case, I thought they got it wrong, but I always think they get it wrong. So in this case, they got it right, so let's just be happy.
So you'll call it out, right?
The Australians then, so they have some legislation which is supposed to force companies to do the right thing with our data, and the Privacy Commissioner has found that Cupid Media broke the law by saving passwords in plain text.
They made it illegal to, or it, yes. It has already been illegal to do that. Wow.
Yes, which is great. And the fact that they are being called out for not just being, you know, it's not just a case of negative publicity now. It is a case of you broke the law, which is great. And I think, well done, Privacy Commissioner. That's how it should be. So I just thought that was worth pointing out.
Wow. So they must have already had that law in place.
Yes. And the commissioner basically went, you have a legal obligation to do your best to protect your customers' data. You stored your passwords in plain text. That is not doing your best. You broke the law. So the law doesn't say do not store in plain text. It says you have a duty to protect, and storing passwords in plain text does not meet that requirement.
By any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, which is good. I like to see, you know, sort of sensible laws for the 21st century. Notable breaches. The lovely app Yo, which to me seems to be the most stupid fad since, I don't know, trolls on pencils or something.
I had trolls on my pencils when I was a little kid.
Yeah, so did I. We were for some reason we were talking about it over coffee and work, which is why that jumped to mind. But yeah, no, so this Yo app, it just sends Yo to people, and they also had a major data breach. Now, the only trickle of good news I can find in this is that they went and hired the hackers who broke in to help them fix it, which is the right way to respond instead of suing them. So that's something.
Okay. Good.
But my advice would be, you know, every time you install an app, you're taking a risk. If the app doesn't actually provide you any functionality, maybe that's not worth doing. But yeah, to each their own.
Functionality is in the eye of the beholder, right?
I guess so. To me, this just seems like, why? But anyway.
There's a keyboard you can get for iOS, I think it must only be Android, that just yells Hodor, which is a character from Game of Thrones who only says Hodor. If you put on the caps lock, it's Hodor in capital letters.
Yeah, that again goes up there in the whole, okay, that's cute, delete from phone.
No, it's a dollar. I'm going to keep it.
The dollar? Wow, that is a clever programmer.
I would absolutely buy that if I had it for the iPhone.
Well, maybe on the way, although I'm wondering if it'll pass Apple's App Store review.
Yeah, maybe not.
Anyway, that just leaves suggested reading. I just want to particularly draw attention to two stories there. So Brian Krebs has a lovely a good explanation of a very annoying new trend where people are extorting particularly restaurants with the threat of giving them bad reviews and stuff online. And they actually send the letter which says in giant writing, notice of extortion. Please pay X amount of Bitcoin.
Wow.
Yeah. It sounds funny until you start reading the article and then you're like, ooh, these people could actually do real harm to businesses who rely on reviews for their revenue.
Wow.
So these threats are real, and it just costs nothing to make the threat, even if 1% of people pay. So it's ha-ha and then ooh. So anyway, the story is there. Brian Krebs goes through it. Also, an interesting bit of research done on stuff like Google Glass and phone cameras and how, you know, we all know that people can look over your shoulder to see your password. But if you throw in some clever image processing tricks and you throw in stuff like Google Glass, suddenly they can see your password from a lot further away than the human eye can. So sort of the bionic eye is more all-seeing than the human eye. And it may... We should perhaps be a little bit more aware of when we're entering our password. We may need to look a little further around us than we thought.
Is that just because it's creating a high-definition image that you can zoom in on? Is that all their premise is?
They're also using something called shadow tracking to sort of figure out where you're pushing, even when they can't see exactly where you're pushing. So they're doing some tricks, which only, obviously, a computer can do and us little humans can't. So they're being clever, which is not in our interest at the moment. But, it's good to know that it can be done. And then other than that, there's just a few other sort of suggested readings on Nest and Google. There's some data sharing going on.
Canada, go ahead and read that one, because that's of concern to me.
Okay, you own a Nest, actually. Yeah, so basically Nest promised when Google bought them, don't panic, we're not sharing our data with Google, don't be silly now. And now they're sharing their data with Google. So Google will know what temperature your house is and when you're home, I guess.
They were just talking a week ago about not to worry about the fact that they bought Dropcam, that just like with Nest, they're not going to share the data with Google.
Yeah, so I never believed this, because we've seen this with Instagram, we've seen this with everyone. When companies buy other companies, they want their stuff. Why else would they buy them?
Well, but the premise was that Nest had a business model that was not based on advertising. That's why they don't have to do this. If they do it, they're choosing to do it to go even farther. They've got they sell a product, a physical product, and they sell they sell that to you. They build it, and they design it, and they ship it to your house. They have a business model. They don't have to do this.
But if you own them, you can take all that money from selling the physical stuff, and then there's this data that you could really use in your other business units. Takes a lot of courage not to go near that pile of very tempting data. It's like putting a whole bunch of candy next to a kid and saying, "Now, I promise I'm not going to eat that."
I guess I'm a little more trusting.
I guess I'm a cynic.
Yeah, and I'm a little more trusting they don't say they're going to sell the anonymized data, do they?
No, but it just adds to the picture of what Google know about you. They start to know when you're home and when you're not home, and it adds to the creepy factor in my book. I would much prefer it if Nest were not owned by Google, but they are, and that's that. Canada has also passed a law to make it opt-in to spam. So if a website, the default checkbox can't be "we'll send you stuff," the default checkbox has to be "we won't send you stuff and you have to opt in," which is kind of clever.
That's actually bacon, not spam. Where bacon is the stuff that you sort of, you went to Macy's to buy something and they made a default checkbox that says "we're going to send crap to you."
Yes. So, we'll see how they get on with that. Companies have 3 years to comply. So it's not going to be an immediate overnight success. Yeah. And just really only mentioning it in passing, I didn't put in the main news because it's only the House of Representatives in the US that have passed a bill to cut the funding for NSA surveillance. But of course, the House passing a bill doesn't make it a law. It's got to go to the Senate and then it's got to go to the President's desk. So this might become real news, but right now it's news in the making, maybe.
Alrighty.
And that's it. We're done.
Vegetables eaten.
Yes. So we get to dive back in.
So where did we last leave our heroes here?
Okay, so last time we started off with, compiled language versus interpreted languages versus the weird in between that is Java, and then we did some practical examples, and that's where we stopped. So if you're scrolling down through the show notes, the last thing we did was example 3, writing a hybrid program in Java, and then we're about to start at loosely typed versus strongly typed languages.
Okay.
So you can sort of look at this massive population of programming languages like a zoo, like some sort of, ecosystem. And you can divide them into the mammals and into the reptiles, which you could say is, your interpreted versus compiled versus we'll have it both ways. And then another completely different way you could divide them up is to say how many legs they have. So we'll say loosely typed versus strongly typed is just another way of splitting the languages. And it's a way that has important to the ongoing discussions because Swift is strongly typed, but Objective-C was loosely typed. So it's one of the things that has people talking because it's changed in Apple's old and new languages. And it has, it's one of those things where loosely typed has some pros, but the cons are it makes way more errors at runtime. And, you know, strongly typed languages are harder to write, but you get some pros in the sense that the compiler can help you more. So I figured the easiest way to do this is to just get stuck in. So first off,
can you tell us what these two things mean? I don't have any idea yet.
Yeah. So every program effectively is just, you have some instructions, you have some data, you do the instructions to the data and out pops something useful. You know, it's the data might be, where is my little player on a game? And the instructions will mush that up to make Mario jump up and down or whatever. But it's always data. And that data has to be stored. Which means that every single programming language has this concept of a variable, which is it's a named place you put information.
Okay.
Okay, and we came across these in Taming the Terminal as well, where we looked at environment variables and shell variables. So same idea here. A variable is a named thing you put data into. Imagine it like a pigeonhole, and you just put information into it. And not all languages have variables, but not all languages work with them in the same way. Every language gets to define its own rules for how variables work. And you can they're not all identical, but you can break them into two categories. So a loosely typed language, the rules are really lax. Basically, you can stick anything you want into any pigeonhole, and the interpreter/compiler is perfectly happy with that. You know, so, okay, fine, I'll hold a number now, and then I might take a string of text later, and then after that I might hold a fraction or a decimal number, or I might hold a true or false value. I'll hold whatever you like. I don't care. And that's a loosely typed language. It really doesn't care.
So it's about the variables.
Yes. So when you in a loosely typed language, you just say, I'll have a variable, please, and I'm going to call it A. And then I can put into A pretty much anything I like.
Okay.
In a strongly typed language, whenever you create a variable, you have to tell it what type of data it can hold. So you don't get to say, I'll just have a variable called A. You're going to say, I'm going to have a variable called A that can hold numbers. And you have to be that specific. So every little receptacle has a type associated with it.
Okay.
And so when you're creating them, you have to say, A is going to hold numbers, B is going to hold strings, C is going to hold a Boolean, whatever.
You said that's in a loosely typed language or strongly typed language?
So loosely typed, anything goes. Strongly typed, you have to be specific.
So I am not a programmer. I have tried to do a little bit of Objective-C, and I very distinctly remember them making me define variables as whether they were strings or whatever. But you said that Objective-C is not a strongly typed language, so I'm confused.
But it's kind of loose. Objective-C is sort of...
They're guidelines?
there's not a perfect... It's all on a scale, right?
Okay.
You can imagine like black is everything is absolutely strictly typed, and white is everything is free as you go, and Objective-C is sort of gray.
Okay.
It's not really very strong, but it's not
completely
loose. Yeah, okay. Yeah, actually, that's a good example. Yes, yes. So let's actually get practical again and get stuck in and just write a very, very simple little program that's loose and then redo it as strong. And that way we'll see the difference.
Ooh, do we get to open the terminal again?
We do indeed. So if you can, the zip file is in the show notes with all of the examples, or you can copy paste from the show notes. So again, if you have your folder and your terminal in the same place, we can get back stuck in again. So example 4 is where we are, which is declaring some variables in a loosely typed language. And we are using Perl for the example. So you will see in ex4-loosevariables.pl, we say, give me a variable called A, and we're going to put in 42. Because we're nerds and that's a good number. In the variable B, we're going to stick in 3.1415 because we're nerds and that's a good number. And then in C, we're going to put the character D. And in D, we're going to put the character donkey. And then we just print them out. So print A, B, C, and D.
Okay, wait a minute. I just remembered. I'm not supposed to be in the terminal. I'm supposed to be in text edit and I'm supposed to be... I'm supposed to turn off the rich format. Make plain text. Okay, now.
There we go.
Okay, so I'm supposed to copy and paste. Let's see, I got to hit the view plain text button on your website. Now it looks beautiful. So I copy that.
And save it as ex4-loosevariables.pl.
All right. So that's loose. Let me review what you've told us. That's loose because it's we've got a number, an integer, a decimal, a single character, and a whole word.
Yeah, and you'll notice that when we're creating them, it's just the same thing. The keyword my to say, I'd like a new variable, please. We give it a name. We give it a value. So there's no difference in creating A or D. Mm-hmm. It's just my name of variable equals A value. And the A value, we have an example of a whole number, a decimal number, a single character, a string of characters. And how we do it is exactly the same. We then print them out. And again, how we print them out makes no difference what's in them. We just say print $A, $B, $C, $D in a new line character. And so if we run that by saying perl ex4 loose variables.pl, you'll see it just prints out 42, 3.1415, D, donkey.
So why did, let's see, I'm looking at the code. Maybe I'm diving into something we need to talk about. But you said the print looks the same for all of them except the $D has a slash n at the end?
No, the slash n just means give me a new line character because otherwise your terminal will be stuck halfway up on a line.
Oh, okay.
It's just, I'm just cleaning up after ourselves. Go on.
Okay. It looks like it's part of the D because it's got the quote, but the quote's
all the way back.
I would have thought the slash n would be outside of the quotes, but okay.
So if you run that, you'll see it just prints out the values and gives you back your terminal.
42, 3.1415, D and donkey. Good.
So it's a loosely typed language because we have at no point had to be specific about our types. We've just created some, put some information in it, some variables, and printed them out. And neither when we were creating it nor when we were printing it did we have to specify any types. So it's entirely loose.
Got it.
So for contrast, let's do it the other way around. Let's do a strongly typed language. And again, we're picking C. So if we take the code below and we paste it into ex5-strongvariables.c, we'll see that it does the same thing. We're declaring a variable called A with the value 42. We're declaring one called B with 3.1415, C with the character D, and then D with the string donkey. And then we're printing them all out. But in this case, we have to say int A because 42 is an integer. We have to say float B because 3.1415 is a floating point number. We have to say car C because D is a character. Then we have to make an array of characters for the donkey because it's lots of characters.
Ugh.
And then when we're printing them, we have to say print a percent D for a number. I don't know why they didn't go percent I, but I didn't write C. Percent F for the float, percent C for the character, and percent S for the string. And then we pass them A, B, C, D. So when we were creating them, we had to say what they were. And when we were printing them, we had to say what they were. And if we had gotten those types wrong, the compiler will tell us to get lost. So you can save the code and compile it, GCC minus O, EX5 strong, space, EX5 strong variable dot C, like last time, and execute it. And the end result will look exactly like what we did in Perl. But we've had to be really specific as we were coding it.
Yeah, this looks like a lot more work.
Mm-hmm. It is.
You're saying it's, but it's less error prone?
Correct, and we're going to prove that point.
Okay.
But not just yet.
We're going to induce errors?
Yes, that is where we are heading with this now. We're going to intentionally break things, which is always fun, right?
There you go.
There's no better way to see how something goes together than to smash it up.
I am such a believer in that. If I can't break it, I can't understand it.
Yes, which is fun. So again, so you've run that and you've seen that the two do the same thing.
Yes, they did.
Yes, they did. But you can see that we had to be way specific in the strongly typed language and we got to be all loosey-goosey in the loosely typed language.
Yeah.
So for now, let's just park that and just say that. Generally speaking, the scripting-y like languages tend to be loose, and the compiled type languages tend to be strong, but that's not an absolute rule. It doesn't have to be that way around. It just sort of is how it happens to be. So Bash scripting is loose, Perl is loose, PHP is loose, Python is loose, JavaScript is loose, Objective-C is loose-ish. I'm calling it loose. We can have a discussion about that. C is definitely strong. C++ is definitely strong. Java is strong-ish. And Swift is strong. So something I'm going to say is that one of these is more work to write, but is less error-prone than the other. And we're going to prove that, but not quite just yet. So I'm going to make a statement, and then I'm going to prove it.
Okay.
The statement I'm going to make is that not all errors are equal.
Hmm.
So there's a whole spectrum of errors us imperfect humans can throw into our code. So in theory, we write a program and we do it perfectly and there isn't a single bug. In practice, that never
happens. That's the way I do it.
Oh, absolutely.
What is the stat they say? How many lines before the typical programmer makes a mistake? Like 9?
We were told when we were studying programming was that, every 9 lines or so you'll make a boo-boo. And there's, most programs have many thousands of lines, which means many boo-boos.
I'm probably close to once every 9 characters.
Those boo-boos are on a spectrum, though. And the spectrum, what we're interested in today, in this discussion, we're going to rank errors based on how hard they are to find and fix.
Hmm.
So the low-hanging fruit is stuff that's just straight away our attention is drawn to it just by the process of programming, and we find them, we fix them, and that's that. And at the other end of the spectrum are the intermittent bugs that happen on the first Tuesday of every week, and you can never quite figure out how you made them happen. Right? That's the worst kind of error. And the best kind of error is one that as soon as you try to do anything, the compiler or the interpreter says, excusez-moi, but look at this here. And so the absolute lowest hanging fruit of them all is the so-called syntax error. So in our human languages, we have rules of grammar. And it doesn't be possible for us to understand bad grammar, as I just proved. Right? You understood what I meant, even though it really wasn't grammatically correct.
Right.
Computers are dumb. This is something I say all the time, but it is true. Computers are dumb. So when you make a grammar mistake in a computer language, the computer's only option is to throw its hand in the air and give up. It just says, sorry, I have no idea what to do with this. You are talking gibberish at me. So to illustrate this point, we're going to intentionally create a syntax error in a compiled language and an interpreted language and watch how they both very quickly make themselves plain. So if we take ex1-hello.c from last week and we duplicate it and save it as ex6-syntaxerror.c.
Hang on. I'm making the mistake of looking in my folder in the Finder. I can't tell which one's .c because that's a hidden character. So,
it should, if you scroll over to the description, one should say C source file and the other one should say Unix binary.
Unix executable C source. There we go. Oh, it has a C on it, too. And the Java one has a J on the logo. Got it, on the icon.
That's because you have Xcode installed.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, so they're Xcode icons.
Okay, that's cute.
So if you right-click and open the C one with text edit,
mm-hmm.
and then go to the last line, which just has the closing curly bracket on, and delete it.
Ooh, I don't, not having closing curly brackets, that's not good.
No. We hit save, and then we try compile. GCC minus O ex6-syntaxerror, ex6-syntaxerror.c, and the compiler will barf. And you will notice it did not create.
Wait a minute. I don't have a file called syntax error.
Okay, but you're supposed to save. Open ex1-hello.c and save it as ex6-syntaxerror.c.
I just saved it.
Oh, well, that'll work too. Then just compile that one and it'll break.
Okay, hang on. So it should just say this. I don't completely understand these compile commands, so let me see what I'm reading. So it says GCC space dash O, and then it's got EX6.
So dash O is where you would like it to go, the name of the executable file that's going to be spat out at the end. So like you were complaining about last time, it's output then input.
Yeah, but why do I have the file name there twice?
Because usually you want to save it to the name. Usually the name of the program and the name of the executable, the C code file are going to be the same. Because why would you call your
what
C file? Okay, the C file is, you generally would name what the C file compiles to the same as the C file, because otherwise you're not going to remember which code went to which app. Which is why they look the same, except they don't have the .c. Look, you can call it whatever you like.
So right? When I compile, I'm creating a second file. I did not know that.
Okay. Yes, because you're compiling the C file into the ones and zeros.
Okay. You just didn't tell me that. Okay. Let's see.
I did last week, because I expressly asked you to look and see that a second file was created. And you said, oh, look, there it is.
Okay.
So when you noticed that, because you had your two files from your EX1 that you were looking at earlier.
I believe.
But in this case, you won't have a second file because the compiler will fail. It will not make you a file. because it's impossible to turn broken code into working ones and zeros.
Yes, it's yelling at me in bright red letters. It says, error, expected yes. closing curly bracket, you moron.
Yes. So you couldn't possibly ship software with a syntax error in it because you would never have anything to ship.
So this is like a grammar error.
Yeah. This is the lowest hanging fruit. Impossible to send someone compiled code with a syntax error in it because it will never have compiled and you will have nothing to ship. Absolute lowest hanging fruit. We can repeat that with an interpreted language and it will also be very low hanging fruit. So if we take the
can
file...
Can I interrupt for a quick second?
Absolutely.
Because Steve and I are just this nerdy, we were talking about your description and of compile versus interpreted languages and the concept of a compiler versus a debugger, where the confusion began. And we together worked out an analogy that we think makes sense, is that when you're compiling it, a grammar error will cause it to fail. Mm-hmm. But a spelling error type failure would not. So if I used the word two and I spelled it T-O-O, but I should have spelled it T-W-O, it wouldn't find that. That's where what you would find maybe in a debugger. You would find that type. And I know I don't mean that you would have grammar errors in a programming language, but as an analogy.
It's a good analogy, yes, because you can end up saying something which is
sounds
correct.
Right.
It's just not what you meant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's definitely a problem.
Right, right, right. So I thought that was kind of a, it brought it a little bit more home to me after Steve explained some of that to me, and then we came up with that analogy.
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now I'll let you talk about, we're going to introduce a syntax error in an interpreted language this time.
Yes. So we're going to again pick Perl. So we're going to take example2-hello.pl that we did last week, duplicate it, save it as ex7-syntaxerror.pl, and this time, we're going to take the line where it says print and misspell it to print, or misspell it any way you like, really, and then save the file and try to run it. And before it does anything at all, the Perl interpreter will say, string found where operator expected, line two. It just will say, sorry. In fact, it says aborted due to compilation errors, or rather, it says execution of blah, aborted due to compilation errors. So you really can't get very far with a syntax error. It's always, always going to be pointed out to you by either the compiler or the interpreter the instant you try to do anything.
Okay, sorry. It takes me a lot longer to do what you say than how fast you say it, so I'm still trying to... I'm getting no... This is fascinating for the listeners, I'm sure, but I don't know what I've done wrong here. I think I didn't name it correctly. Changing the names is really that adds a lot of extra time for me here, so I'm not executing.
Well, you don't have to change the names
to do it.
You don't have to change the names. You don't want to. You just got to try execute the one that you hobbled.
Okay, but then I have to go figure out what I, because I tried to do what you said.
Well, so you have it open in front
there
of you
go.
In text.
I got
edit.
It now. Okay, string found where operator expected near print.
Yeah,
you need to pre-declare print.
So it doesn't really know what you meant. It's sort of having a guess that maybe you forgot to include a library or something, and maybe there is a print command that you could have defined. Mm-hmm. But it certainly has no idea what to do with it, and it means it can't run your code because it's like, I don't know what you said.
Yeah.
And so those syntax errors just fall out straight away. As soon as you try to run the interpreted language, or as soon as you try to compile the compiled language, the compiler/interpreter immediately spots them and says, bah! Right, broken.
Now Perl didn't write it error in red, so I sort of like C better.
Yeah, okay. That is, and the C error. In fact, GCC is being particularly nice because it also pointed out which bracket wasn't matched.
Mm-hmm.
It says that notice that I was expecting a bracket to match the one on line four, and it didn't show up anywhere.
But maybe if we'd made that kind of error, Perl would have told us that, or no?
We would have said unmatched brackets, but see, there were no brackets in the Perl example, so I couldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, and actually, Perl is saying, so you got this thing here, you're calling print, and I don't know what it is. Did you need to pre-declare that? And you're going to look at it and go, oh, I guess print isn't a word.
Yeah, exactly.
It.
So it's trying to be helpful as well.
Yeah.
But again, they have very little intelligence, these computery things. So it didn't sort of say, oh, that looks awfully like print. Maybe he meant print. It's just going to go, I don't know what the hell this is.
So it's like a literal person. I could have known what you meant, but I'm just not going to.
Yeah, exactly. So at the very other end of the spectrum, so that's the lowest hanging fruit, right? Your syntax errors, they're always going to show up. But at the very other end of the spectrum, we have our logic errors, where someone has written a spec for a program, or maybe they've written like a whole protocol or something. And actually, they made a logic error in creating the protocol. And so the programmer has done exactly what they were told, but they were told to do a wrong thing, which is quite similar to your analogy. Mm. And no compiler on the planet can ever possibly help you there.
Right, right. If your logic is wrong, it's just wrong.
Yeah. And so that is the worst possible kind of error to have to try to figure out, because no tool can help you, because the problem is with your thinking in the first place. You have exactly done the wrong thing.
So you really should blame the programmer then.
Or the person who wrote the spec.
No, I'm kidding.
However, what we can say, so we have this, you know, we have two extremes of the spectrum, right? The syntax errors will always be found, and the logic errors will never be found. But there's an in-between bit, which is stuff that, depending on how you've designed your language, may or may not be found. And so that's where we're going to look at here, because depending on our individual language, it either will or won't work. From the point of view, we're trying to say that good errors are ones that are easy to find, and bad errors are ones that are hard to find. That's sort of what we're deciding is important today, which is a good thing to think of. And what that means is that runtime errors suck. Stuff that doesn't show up until your app is running are much worse than stuff that shows up before your app ever gets to run. And we've all seen this, right? You've been using, say, Aperture for 4 hours, and then all of a sudden it falls over in a heap.
Right.
That's a runtime error. So they're bad. So runtime errors suck.
And so runtime errors where it's working, but then it just doesn't.
Yeah, so it works for most situations it encounters, and then something happens. Maybe you had the mouse in the wrong place, and you know there's something in the code that doesn't just show itself, it only shows itself sometimes. And they are the absolute worst, because you know you do a quick cursory test, you fire it up, oh look, it launches, it's great, my app works. Only the problem shows up half an hour in, and only sometimes, or only if you do a certain thing. So they're the worst kind, they're your runtime errors. So we're going to contrive a runtime error. Now, being an example, it's going to be a little bit contrived. In the real world, they tend to be way more pernickety than this. But we're going to make some code that mostly works, yeah, and sometimes doesn't.
Nice. Was that hard to write? Because you've written some code here?
Oh, no, no. It's quite easy to write, because mathematics is full of these little things that mostly work, but not when you give them some input. So we're going to write a little C program to start with. It's called ex8 divide.c, which may give you some idea where we're going here.
Ooh, so we're divide by zero, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
Look at me go.
So we write a little program that expects you to put two command line arguments behind it, and it will divide those two by each other. And so if you look at the code, we have a little thing saying, if we didn't get our arguments, whine.
He actually did write that in the comments here.
Yeah, that I do that.
Why not? You might as well entertain the people reading it.
Exactly. And because we are a strongly typed language in C, we have to make an effort to convert the string that was typed in by the user into numbers. So we have to convert our numbers to integers A and integer B. Then we divide A by B to make a new integer called ants for answer. And then we print it out. We say one number divided by another number equals whatever the answer was. So we save and compile that. So I'll let you do that.
All right. Luckily, I got a little bit ahead of you while you were talking, so I think I'm ready to compile it. Uh-oh. Yeah, there you go. For a second, I thought you didn't give me the compile command. So I do not know that by heart yet. Okay. I'm compiled.
So you've compiled. So let's start off easy. So we say .exa-divide 100 space 100 space 4. So we're going to divide 100 by 4. You hit enter. Prints out 100 divided by 4 equals 25.
Yay! I'm a programmer. Look at me go.
You could repeat that with 9 and 3, 16 and 4, 270 and 90. But where I want you to make it go wrong is to type .exa divide space 22 space 0.
Floating point exception 8.
Yeah, it just goes,
my program was working perfectly. What's wrong?
Yep. And you can very easily accidentally introduce a divide by 0 error if you're using some sort of variable input like mouse position and dividing it by something else. Someone puts the mouse at exactly the top left corner at 0, 0. If you're dividing by mouse position, oops. right? So you can do this kind of thing in code, but there are lots of other ways you can trigger a runtime error. But divide by zero is a good one because it just, well, obviously you can't divide by zero. That makes no sense.
I really like this because I never knew what a runtime error was.
There you go. So our program works for most numbers until we throw in a zero and then it falls over in a heap. Mm-hmm. And we can, that's a compiled language. We can do the same in Perl. So if we write the same code in Perl, what you may notice is it's shorter because Perl is a loosely typed language. So we don't have to convert anything to anything. We just say, give me the two numbers from the command line, divide one by the other, print it out. And also whine. I put in the whine bit just to be consistent.
Okay, wait a minute. So, all right, I got to save this and give it this name, EX9. So I want to go back, but give me 1 second to read it too. So it says, make sure we got two arguments or whine. Okay, unless scalar ARGV something something two. Oh, that's if you didn't give it two arguments.
Yes.
Read the numbers from the arguments, do the division, print the answer. Okay.
Actually, one of the reasons I adore Perl is because it's very Englishy. You'll notice that in most languages, you'd have to say if and then the not symbol and then your whatever. Whereas in Perl, it has the keyword unless, which I love.
Yeah.
Because it's just Englishy. Unless this thing happens, whine. So if we do it again, so we say Perl space EX9 divide.pl 104, 25, 393, 3, 16, 4, 4,
270, 93,
I think. Yeah.
Got it.
Works fine. We give it 22 and 0 again. It also falls over in a heap.
But with some information this time. Illegal division by 0.
Yeah, so Perl is a little bit more polite. It's telling you exactly what went wrong instead of floating point error 8.
Right, right.
Which the manual will tell you means you divided by 0, but not quite as helpful as Perl is there. So we have created an example of this sort of random error that gets triggered sometimes in both a compiled and interpreted language.
So some of them you didn't really learn anything different between the two, though. They both
not yet.
Found it.
Yes.
Okay.
So they both didn't find it. In fact, right? They both The compiler didn't help you there. It didn't save you. The C compiler compiled the code, said there's nothing wrong with this. You ran it, and then something.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Okay.
Right. It failed to help you.
Right.
But that's not always true. Okay. So in this case, neither one was able to help. But sometimes they can help depending on how you design the language. And so you can do what you'll hear people say is pushing runtime errors to compile time. That's sort of the golden, that's what you're hoping to achieve when you're designing a language you're going to use for writing big applications that you want to be robust. You want to push as many errors from the icky runtime scenario into the compile time scenario. You want to push them that way. And so let's try to do that. So again, we're working off division for our contrived examples because division is just a good thing to break, right? Mm-hmm. So in a loosely typed language, the compiler has no way of spotting type errors.
Type as in typo?
No, as in when you get stuff wrong in terms of the types of your variables, right? It makes sense to divide a number by a number. It doesn't make sense to divide a number by a string.
Oh, and because you haven't ever told it this is a number and this is a string, a loosely typed language would never know to tell you you screwed that up?
Until you try to do it, until it's executing, and then it goes,
okay.
What? I can't do this. Whereas a strongly typed language, the compiler knows what everything holds. And so if the compiler sees you taking a number and trying to divide it by a string, the compiler says, no. This divide operator here expects a number and a number, and this is not a number and a number. Error. And so you've pushed a problem from runtime to compile time. And so to prove that point, we're going to intentionally create a type error in Perl, which is loose. And it's not going to get caught up until we actually got to run it. So to do this, we're creating a subroutine, or just a little, you know, it's like a little mini program within a program. And the subroutine is going to divide two numbers. Not a very exciting subroutine. Just basically return one number divided by the other number.
Okay.
And then we're going to just print out a little statement saying, print I am running, which means this proves to us that this is happening at runtime because you will see the program has started to do stuff. It will print out I am running and then it will break.
Okay.
Because
I just read ahead in your code. That's why I'm giggling. Yes. Go ahead.
So I'm going to create variable A and variable B and try to divide them. Variable A will be 4, which is very sensible. Variable B will be baboon. You cannot divide 4 by a baboon. And so it will print, I'm running, and then it will fall over in a heap. So if you save the code there and try to run it, you will see it says, I'm running Illegal Evasion by Zero.
I do have to say, though, that Mark Dalton posted on Facebook today that a picture from the news of a woman who stabbed her husband with a squirrel.
Do who?
Yeah, he didn't give us any more than that, but it's sort of like dividing four by a baboon. It's the same
thing.
It is
a bit, yeah.
Anyway, yes, Illegal Division by Zero.
Now, you may be saying to yourself, hang on a sec, that's not the error I would have expected.
No.
The reason is because Perl has done its best to be helpful. It has said, okay, I got a string, I wanted a number, why don't I try convert the number, the string to a number? Only the string didn't actually contain anything remotely numeric, so it went, okay, well, that's equivalent to zero. And then it went ahead and divided by zero.
Oh, which can't
It tried to help, yeah, but it didn't prove very helpful.
Not very.
No. So this is a runtime error. You saw it print, I'm running, and then fall over in a heap. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't picked up at the moment the script was being compiled.
And it's even less helpful because it said divide by zero. It does tell us which line we messed up.
Yes, it tells us where the code was. I was on line 8 and then I just had no idea what to do.
Right.
So let's try do that and see. Let's try to make the same mistake intentionally.
Okay.
So again, we define a little subroutine, int divide. And you'll notice that straight away, when I'm defining the subroutine, I have to say int divide. In other words, this subroutine is going to return a number. And then say that the subroutine expects two arguments, which are going to be an int called x and an int called y. So again, we're typing everything. And then we just return one divided by the other. And then we try to create our two variables, int a equals 4. But we have to say that our baboon is a string. So he's a character array baboon. Then I say int ants equals divide a comma b. We run it through the compiler. Warning, incompatible pointer to integer conversion, passing character to parameter type int. So it's actually saying, I wanted an int, I got a character. I got a character string of 7 long.
Well, sure, you told it was a character. It's not like it did any work.
Right. So the compiler has straight away said this, the what the, who the, what the, right? So the compiler has been able to flag this problem for us before we ever got as far as even trying to run the code. And it's pointed exactly to where the problem is. An arrow at the B and an arrow at the int Y. These two do not go into each other. And it was able to help us because it's a strongly typed language.
Okay, meaning you told it what you were doing. Yeah.
So it could tell, because in the other one it just couldn't tell.
Ah, here's something I'd love to check. What if I said baboon was an integer? It wouldn't have caught it.
It then complained that you tried to put baboon, which is not an integer, into an integer.
Oh,
you
okay,
can try
so
it, there,
it would have done that line. It would have figured that out.
It would have then complained that the things on each side of the equals were not the same type.
All right, I'm going to do that because I want to make,
yeah,
I want to
means.
Make let's see, int b baboon.
So int b without the square brackets because it equals
so
baboon.
It says, let's see, it says, warning incompatible pointer to integer conversion initializing int with an expression of type character. So it's essentially the same, pretty
same
close
problem,
to the same
right?
error.
Yeah, and the problem is the same. You're trying to shove baboon into a number.
Yeah, but it finds the error earlier to say baboon ain't no number.
Yeah, which is true.
Yeah, that's probably the more common error, right? You're probably not real likely to try to divide four by a baboon, but you might be like just not thinking and
okay, but imagine this was a more complicated code base. And in reality, usually you're using subroutines that have come from a library. And so it's actually very easy to accidentally pass the wrong type to a subroutine that does something complex. It may expect 5 arguments.
Okay.
And you may have put them in the wrong order.
Or there could be user interaction as well, right? Where you tell them, put in your zip code here, and they type their mother's maiden name.
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of ways you can accidentally end up with a type error. And so this is a contrived example, obviously, because we have to fit it into this discussion. But it does illustrate the point that the compiler knows what everything is, and so we can see when you're doing something stupid.
That's an excellent illustration, Bart. That's really good. That feels like it's going to stick.
Excellent. So this is why a strongly typed language tends to produce more robust code, because these problems have been pushed to compile time. And that's good, because that means they were flagged before anyone ever shipped an app. Whereas in an interpreted language, you can have the code in use for a week before you stumble into a potential problem that may only show itself up sometimes that is a type error. So you might think, well, obviously, loosely typed languages are all bad.
Yes.
You're right. And, you know, but again, this is always about swings and roundabouts and using the right tool for the right job. So our Lucy-type language actually has an advantage. It has two advantages. A, it's way quicker to write Lucy-typed code. So if you're just writing a quick little script to automate something, it's way easier to do that in a Lucy-type language. But also, your code can do a lot more sometimes. Let's prove this with an example. So let's take examples 8 and examples 9. So EX8 divide, which is our C program that was strongly typed, and EX9-divide, which is our Perl program that's Lucy typed, and they both divide numbers. So let's give our C program, let's give it 10 and 3 to deal with. So we're going to divide 10 and 3. And when we run it, so .EX8-divide(10,3), it says 10 divided by 3 equals 3.
Oh.
Oops.
Because we never told it to give us a floating point?
Yeah, because we told it your input's an integer, your output's an integer. So integers are all
it knows. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was a while ago. I don't remember.
So, yeah, but we had to type it. It's a strongly typed language, so we had to tell it you're an integer.
Ah.
So it only works with integers.
Yeah, I'm losing track of which one's which here. So yeah, our example 8 was
strong.
C, which is a strongly...
Yes.
Okay.
We can also make it go nuts by making it divide 5 and 0.25, which it will round to 0 and then give our floating point exception again.
Okay.
So that broke. Okay. Right? But our Perl code did the same thing in a loose language. What happens if we throw the Perl code the self-same inputs? Mm. And the answer is the Perl code has no problem because it's a Lucy-type language and it's perfectly happy to switch between whole numbers and fractions as and when needed. So when we tried to divide 10 by 3, we get 3.33333333. When we divide 5 by 0.25, we get 20, which is, of course, correct.
Yeah.
So the Lucy
Lucy-type language has the ability to interpret what you probably meant, or
it's more flexible. It's not what you probably meant; it's what you actually meant. It was able to be flexible.
Well, wait a minute. For all you know, you wanted the answer to be to be an integer. In which case, C did it correctly. So 10 divided by 3 is 3.
True, but if you really wanted it to be an integer, you could do that in Perl using the seal, floor, or round commands, which will round up, round down, or round closest.
But since we didn't tell it, it did it the math.
So what we basically got was 2 for the price of 1 here. Basically, our Lucy-type language was able to speak in whole and fractional numbers, but for our compiled one, we had to decide. And so you could rewrite example 8 with floating points, and then you will find that every time you print them out, you get your 5 decimal places, whether you want them or not.
Right.
So it will convert 10 to 10.0000 and 3 to 3.000. So it's never as nice as the loosely typed language, which is just doing the right thing. So swings and roundabouts, it's always swings and roundabouts. The thing is, for a small script, you want it to be quick to write and to be flexible. For a big app, you want as many as possible problems brought to compile time because there's tens of thousands of lines of code to look through if something goes wrong. So if you're trying to develop for OS X or for iOS, you really do want a language that pushes as many as possible errors to the compiler because a runtime error is so much more catastrophic in a big, complicated code base.
I do find the word push interesting. I would have called it pull. I understand there's conventions that are all backwards and all of this stuff, but it's like you want to pull it forward in time. Push later to me, but I get it.
Yeah, okay, that's a fair point. I never thought of it like that.
But hey, this program, these languages go right to left, so what do I know?
Well, look, they do all sorts of weird things sometimes. You're absolutely right.
Well, that's very interesting. So, what about something like AppleScript? Is that loosely or strongly?
Oh, very, 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 very loose.
Okay.
AppleScript is wonderfully loose. And I mean, there's other advantages to Lucy-type languages because they're so flexible that you can pretty much store anything in a variable in a Lucy-type language like JavaScript or Perl. You can save an entire subroutine into a variable, which allows you to do really cool stuff. Like, actually, I'll give you a practical example. So I'm working on the code for the new XKPassWD.
Mm-hmm.
And a feature that people have asked, because I'm using the standard randomization functions in Perl because that way there's no requirement on you to install libraries to use my code, which makes it much easier to automate it with Automator and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the random function in Perl is good enough, in my humble opinion, for 99.99999% of people. But people have said to me, but no, I want to use a custom randomization function of a different... I want a really, really, really good randomness. I want to make a query to random.org and use that. So, okay, so I could either sort of pre-imagine every possible source of randomness and put in an option that when you're using it, you decide which one you want. Or, and what I actually did in the code, you will find that there's a variable in the code which allows you to give it, to store in that variable, a subroutine. And that subroutine will be used every time randomness is needed.
Ah.
So I ship the code with a subroutine that just uses the default source of randomness, and that is the default setup. But if you want to use your own, you change the value of that variable to your own subroutine, and now you have a new source of randomness in my code.
Hmm.
So anyway, really cool stuff like that you can do with Lutey-type languages. They're fun.
Yeah, your reaction to when I said, is AppleScript loose or strong, you said, oh, it's lovely, it's loose. So that's because it's easy to do quick little things, right?
Which is exactly what it's for, in fairness, yes.
Yeah.
And AppleScript is a very, very flexible little language. I still find it really head-wrecking because it tries to be English but isn't quite English enough to work. But it's nice. And when you see someone else's AppleScript, it usually reads quite nicely. The problem I have is writing the stuff myself.
Does it let you put in silly comments like you do?
Oh, yeah. Every language has a comment feature.
Good. I do think it's a good idea to entertain the people who have to read your code.
Well, usually that's me.
So, better.
Exactly.
I knew a guy who believed that it would be job security if he put all of his comments in Vietnamese so that none of us could read it. He still got fired.
Yeah, because what he's doing there is sabotaging the team.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which of course had, you could see him exhibiting that behavior in other ways. So that didn't help him. So yeah, just entertain people. Why not? Right.
Absolutely. No, like I regularly, like I have a colleague in work who's even more of a sense of humor than me when it comes to comments. And I'll regularly find things in the comments like Thunderbirds are go. And, you know, so the code has passed all validation. So Thunderbirds are go, go create the account or go set up the email address or whatever. And I just love when you stumble across those little, those little fun nuggets hidden away in the comments.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Thunderbirds are go.
There is also there's the famous saying in computer science. I hope this is, I don't know. I think it's, anyway, yeah. So it's basically so code comments are like sex. You know, any at all is better than none.
However inappropriate, I think it's perfect. That's a great,
so you can bleep that out if you like. But it's, it
no, no, it's
it.
Okay.
So let's wrap up our discussion. So all programming languages have the same basic function in life, which is to translate from something us humans can read to something the computer can actually do. So we're always trying to find ways of telling a computer what to do. But there's a million ways to skin that cat. And so there is this zoo of different languages. And all of those languages have different properties. So we can sort of group them like you would try to create, you know, the tree of animals. And so we can split them in two and say some are compiled and some are interpreted and some are somewhere in between. We can say some are loosely typed, some are strongly typed, some are somewhere in between. And all of these decisions have an effect on how the language behaves, which means that some languages are good for some things and other languages are good for different things. And so it's never about saying this is the perfect language. It's about saying this language is the most suited to this task.
Okay. Okay.
And we also, like, we have covered two of the things which split languages up, which is how they deal with types and how they deal with actually doing the translation to ones and zeros. So in other words, compiled versus interpreted and loose versus strongly typed. But there's at least 20 other criteria I could come up with off the back of my head, right? I mean, there are just loads of them. Is it object-oriented? Is it functional? Is it imperative? All of these things. But I didn't want to muddy the waters by getting into stuff that isn't practical. So I just chose two very, very specific ways to differentiate them.
Yeah, no, this has been excellent. I get it.
Excellent.
And as always, if we can explain it to me, figure everybody else can keep up, right?
I hope so. I mean, that's the theory. So hopefully that works out that way. So ultimately, what all this comes around to is the reason that people are so happy about Swift is that you can make a really good argument that Swift is a better fit to the job of writing robust applications for OS X and iOS than Objective-C was. So it's not that Swift is a better language full stop, it's that Swift is a language more suited to developing apps for OS X and iOS.
Because it's strongly typed and Objective-C was loosely typed.
Loosely-ish, yeah. Whereas Swift is very strong. And Swift also actually does something... Swift removes some shortcuts. So in the C language, for example, you can be a little bit sloppy with some of your curly brackets. Now, they always have to come in pairs because otherwise the compiler has no idea what you mean. But sometimes they're optional. And that famously led us to the go-to-fail bug because C didn't enforce those curly brackets. But Swift does. In Swift, there is no shortcut. Those brackets are not optional. They always have to be there. And so you can't make the mistake that led to go-to-fail.
Right.
So it is just, it's just well-suited to the job, and that's why it's so nice to see. And it shouldn't be a surprise that this has been used behind the scenes in Apple for quite a few years, and it's sort of been in the making for quite some time, because obviously Apple know the problems they run into with Objective-C, so who better to, you know, replace Objective-C with a better language for the job than Apple?
I like it.
So I'm hoping that, A, that the discussions about Swift make a little more sense to people, but B, that maybe I've whetted some of your appetites, and maybe you'll give programming a go, because, look, it's not that hard. We just did it there.
Yeah, with you typing all the code in, it was pretty easy.
Okay, but it's not like looking at Japanese. You can see that it is quite human-friendly, even if it's going to take some learning.
Right, right. Well, very cool, Bart. I have really enjoyed this, and I do think I understand. I know this was a bit off of our Taming the Terminal series, but we got to play in the terminal.
We did.
To do some compiling, some code. We got to try a bunch of different languages, so it's all good.
Excellent. Well, and the next time, I promise, we've been promising for so long to get into the searchy stuff in the terminal, but we are going to be back on target next time, which I guess will be in 3 weeks because I've gone out of sequence.
Who knows? It's a mystery to all of us.
Whenever it is, right? Until then, happy computing.
Well, by Jove, I think I got it. I think I followed what he was talking about. That was exciting. I'm really, really enjoying these conversations. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mango Learning at BlueMangoLearning.com, makers of Clarify. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions, your user recordings. Like, I just think I just convinced Ken K from Ann Arbor into doing a recording for us on a cool new gadget he's got that sounds like fun. You can do all that by emailing me at Allison@podfeed.com. Follow me on Twitter and app.net over at Podfeed. Check out the new Silicast Google Plus community. We had a huge discussion of this Aperture being retired or dead conversation. Had a lot of interesting conversation, a lot of people talking about it. And it's a really active community, but not overwhelming. So it's a lot of fun. You should go check it out over at podfeed.com/Google Plus. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeed.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, like CJ did this week, and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.